Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 2:10 p.m. and that's Friday, August 28th. And today being Friday, of course, is the big picture, long-term audio for the various different asset classes. This has been an incredibly tumultuous week, and there's a lot to talk about. But trying to put this in the long-term perspective is probably one of the things that are the most productive things that we can do. It's very easy to draw very short-term conclusions and to become a little bit panicky, and there is certainly a lot of people doubting their resolve, considering the depth and speed with which the market pulled back on Monday following the decline on Friday and the revaluation of the Chinese yuan, and then the subsequent just incredibly impressive bounce that we've had from the lows in such a wide number of markets. Well, people are obviously going to be looking back at their performance and they'll be saying to themselves, what could I have done better? How can I do better the next time around? And what should my strategy be going forward? And these are very, very large questions. And it's probably worth considering some of these questions from the perspective of different participants within the market. Well, there are going to be those that did not have stops and were holding long positions, saw very red territory, or maybe didn't get back from holiday until Wednesday and saw these impressive bounces. Well, what they will be thinking of is, golly, I got out of this rather good. I might be down on the year, but I'm not down as much as I could possibly have been if I had closed my position on Monday. Well, they're going to be the people that saw the massive declines and said, well, that's a 10% correction, so I'm going to buy the dip and here we go. So that would help to, as they were the kind of people that helped the market to go higher. But what about the people that are trying to manage an investment position and have risk metrics which they rely on to dictate how large that position can be? What we often term, what people that are not relying on any kind of metric tend to think about is, oh, this is my position and this is how large it is relative to my available capital and this is how much money that I hope that I can make from it. But when you're managing an institutional portfolio, what you'd be thinking more about is, how much exposure do I have to this risk asset and what is my potential drawdown? Well, what we have seen this week is that volatility measures spiked to the upside. And a spike in volatility, and that's a point that I've made in quite a number of these big picture Friday audios, but a spike in volatility necessarily means that algorithmic trading systems must reduce their position sizes. And that's one of the reasons that we had such an aggressive sell-off, is because the only way that you can have an algorithmic trading system is you have to write your program and say, well, I want you to buy on this situation and I want you to sell on this situation, but there is only one way that you can dictate how much to buy or sell, and that is based on the volatility of that particular instrument. Because you could say, well, tell the computer to buy this thing if this thing occurs. But how much do you tell the computer to buy? You say, well, this thing is going to, its historic volatility is 5%. Therefore, our potential drawdown on the purchase is 5%. And then you have to give it a certain stop of 5%. And then, based on the size of the stop, the position size is calculated relative to the available capital. However, the ability of an automatic trading system to tailor the position size will be influenced very largely by the volatility on that instrument. So if volatility increases, the position size must decrease. And the smarter programs would then have an algorithm in place that if volatility goes above X value, that the position would re-reversed. And the exact same method would be used to size a short position. Well, this the only possible way that you can write a program like that. So doesn't matter what the strategy is, the decision-making process is for the buy and sell recommendation within the strategy, the sizing of the position has to be based on the volatility. And volatility has been incredible this week. That the VIX spiked higher on Monday, but individual stock volatility has been high, and not just this week, it's been high for over the last month, where you've had just very large moves, and that could well have contributed to the decline that we've had, because it would shift the risk metrics of automatic trading systems. Well, that's, I suppose you could consider that that's an analysis of the some of the contributing factors to what happened in the big drawdown that we had on Monday. Now ask yourself, none of the moves that we saw in very large shares like General Electric, Johnson & Johnson, Walmart, or Colgate was, well, Walmart had already been pulling back, but certainly the Colgate and the other two, these were incredibly large moves, which aren't really based in fundamentals at all. Then you look at some of the actions that you've had in ETFs. Well, ETFs are going to have a problem in a market that's flooded with sell signals, or sell orders, because they won't be able to execute in time. Their ability to achieve a favorable price for their inventory isn't going to match up, and then you're going to see dislocations in the price. Well, that's a problem that they're always going to have as long as they're intraday traded, and that's one of the reasons that people like them, is because they're intraday traded. So this isn't a problem that's going to go away. In fact, this is only going to get worse. That when people understand that a large pullback can have a very deleterious effect on the value of ETFs, well, then they're going to get targeted. That's an easy way to make money. That you pick out the weak member of the herd and target that one. That's the predatory nature of crowds means that that is a potential risk for ETFs, and particularly for ETFs that are trading in illiquid securities. Now, that certainly wasn't the case, for example, with the biotech index, because those are large liquid shares, and yet it wasn't able to fulfill its orders in the kind of time required to allow or to avoid the kind of drawdown that it had in such an incredibly short period of time. None of this is positive for sentiment. So, the parallels are with the flash crash in 2010. And we've had other instances of flash crashes, but not on major indices like the S&P 500 or the NASDAQ. Well, what we saw the last time was that the big question, and everyone was asking it, was this important? Did it really change anything? And it changed something because we were all talking about it. Everybody had had the damage to their sentiment, and the number of people lining up to potentially buy a bounce and to be the first to push to pay additional high levels had been depleted. Everyone was waiting for someone else to do it, and then that translated into a 2 to 3 month period of time where prices were weak, and it took time for support to be rebuilt before the market recovered again. Well, we're only still in this week, in the week of the decline and the subsequent bounce. And none of the questions about the damage that has been done to sentiment have been answered yet. In fact, you might say that the questions haven't even been asked yet. So it's really too early to sound the all clear. And that's a short-term consideration. Well, medium-term, when we look at the various asset classes, then the US economy is going from strength to strength. The economic growth forecasts have rebounded really robustly from the decline that we had due to, you know, very inclement weather in the first part of the year. The housing market is slowly but surely improving, and, you know, we're starting to get wage growth. Well, you know, that's really positive stuff. And, you know, it's the timing coincides with, you know, what Reinhardt and Rogoff told us 6 or 7 years ago, that the end of a credit crisis, or the aftermath of a credit crisis recession, is characterized by these, by a slow burn economic revival, and that can last upwards of 6 to 7 or even 8 years. Well, guess what? It's been 7 years. So, you know, this is pretty much right on schedule that we would have economic liftoff around this time. The US dollar is starting to price that in, you know, that the US economy doesn't or no longer needs to have the weakest currency in the world. And that's quite a large change, because for the decade from, you know, 2001 to 2 onwards, then the US really did need the weakest currency in the world, and by golly, it got it. So, you know, we had just an incredible boom in emerging market and commodity currencies because of the weakness of the US dollar. You know, that encouraged, you know, capital migration from the US to, you know, more lucrative emerging markets, where they the pickup in the currency and the pickup in capital markets more than compensated for the risk, and not least because the dollar was trending lower. And it encouraged emerging market and commodity-based borrowers to take out large loans in US dollars, because they had the belief that their currencies would continue to appreciate, and that would make repaying those loans even better. But of course, now that you have this US dollar, which is no longer trending lower, then the pressure that that is putting on US dollar debtors is becoming really quite intense, and it's looking increasingly likely that we are going to see some form of default. And the other side of that equation is that a lot of the money that has moved into emerging markets due to the weakness of the dollar is now migrating back. So, you know, this isn't something that's really going to end anytime soon. This is a long-term, you know, and by that I mean upwards of a decade-long trend, where we could have a strengthening dollar well into the medium term. And that's particularly against the emerging market and commodity currencies. Well, that doesn't take anything from the fact that the dollar is overbought relative to those currencies at the present time, and that there is the potential right now for, you know, some unwinding of that overbought condition. But it's unlikely to be anything more than that. That it would really be very difficult to really make an argument for preeminence. There are the same kind of preeminence in the commodity markets and emerging market currencies that we had in the prior decade. You know, there will be individual success stories, certainly, but the commonality in that sector is gone, and that's unlikely to return. Well, when we look at China, and China is the epicenter of risk right now. It's obviously the largest emerging market currency. It's the largest emerging market stock market, and it's the world's second largest economy. So, you know, what happens there is a big deal. And, you know, what we're seeing right now is, you know, an administration where a great deal of power has been concentrated in the hands of one person. And, you know, delegation really wouldn't go astray. You know, that what we need to see is improving standards of governance, and concentrating that much power in the hands of one person is not improving governance. So, you know, the mishandling of the IPO sector last year, the mishandling of the bull market and the subsequent crash, and the mishandling of the revaluation of the currency, and you can describe that revaluation any way you want. You can say it's a devaluation. You can say that they timed it exactly right so that they would get a devaluation, or that, you know, they are doing exactly what they require in order to gain greater credibility from the IMF for their currency. But you know, we can debate the reasons ad nauseum, but the effect is that the reputation of the Chinese administration has been tarnished, and you know, that's going to take time to recover. But the very fact that they're supporting the stock market in the couple of days before this saber-rattling military parade, you know, is not a positive indication that, you know, there's no guarantee that the market lows are going to hold in the aftermath of that parade. What do you do after you've had this really what is a nonsensical celebration? So, you know, this is still a taut environment. There's been a lot of value created in China, and when we do eventually see is, you know, support coming in at progressively higher levels, well, then that will give us some evidence on which to hang a recovery argument. But right now, we just don't have it yet. You know, this is a difficult environment for China because they are slowly migrating from a command economy to one more influenced by the consumer. And you know, this is bumpy, and it's been going on for a while, and it has a lot longer to go. And what it's going to require eventually is the sacrifice of power and letting the reins of control ease somewhat. And there isn't a great deal of evidence just yet that the Communist Party is willing to do that. So we're still in a taut environment. And that's true of just about all of the emerging markets. By and large, you know, this is a major turning point for the global economy. That emerging markets and commodity markets have had it all their own way for much of the last 10 years. And it's very obvious the countries that have succeeded in improving their governance. You know, India is certainly one of those. And we will get additional evidence over the next couple of years as to exactly which are the countries that really have succeeded. But what's perhaps more important is that, you know, and we have ample evidence of this from our own economies, it's that when people move up a bracket in terms of their consumption, they don't generally tend to go back. You know, when people start buying toilet tissue, when their calorie intake improves, when women begin to buy cosmetics, when people start to move from motorcycles to cars, then you know they don't tend to regress, and that's an important factor. It means then that consumer demand growth might moderate due to the relative strength of the US dollar, but it's unlikely to reverse. And that's an important consideration from the rise of the global middle class. And considering that we're in a period of time where you have literally hundreds of millions of people entering the workforce over the next decade, then the pressure that is going to be brought to bear on governments and on administrations to deliver the standards of governance necessary to generate economic growth and jobs will mean that we are either going to have a very benign environment or we're going to have a very tumultuous environment. And the reality is that some countries will do very, very well and others won't. We're already seeing a great deal of evidence for that in the Middle East, where there are some countries that have just been abject failures in improving their standards of governance over the last 40 years, now have large populations and low commodity prices, and are going to run into problems, and are already running into problems, and there are wars in quite a number of countries there. Well, considering that they're competing with each other to pump oil and you know, the particularly Saudi Arabia and Iran are competing for the same market share, then that has contributed to lower oil prices. And this isn't something that's likely to change. That the competition for market share will only be exacerbated by the fact that oil prices are lower, because all of these countries have large young populations and, you know, pretty accommodative social security schemes. So, you know, this governance is everything that we've talked about for years is more and a more important fact today than it ever has been. The fact that oil prices are low is and are bouncing in the short term suggests that the old area where $40 was a previous area of resistance, it's now a potential area of support. And we've seen oil prices bouncing from this level twice. There's, in the current environment where we have such an excess of supply because of this competition between major suppliers, then there is the potential that prices will eventually go lower. But in the short term, there's a bounce going on in the energy sector. And there's a bounce going on in the industrial metals sector. You know, that has led to the energy sector and the material sector being among the best performers this week, not least because they're coming off of such depressed levels. Well, there is also an indication, and we don't have confirmation of it yet, but you know that it's not beyond the bounds of possibility that we're finally starting to see the energy sector and the resources sector beginning to respond to better economic growth in both Europe and the USA. And that's a generally speaking a late in the cycle event where you get incredibly depressed levels on resources shares and then they move to positions of outperformance. So they are certainly worth watching, and not least because some are so incredibly overextended relative to the respective trend means that even in an environment where they simply revert to the mean, they could go up by 20%. Well, when we think then about technology, well, the Nasdaq has roared back from its intraday or its intra-week low. But at the same time, there's also the point that we have an environment where the stock market has been going up now for upwards of 6 years. And this isn't likely to persist forever without a lengthier period of consolidation following such an incredible breakout. That in the absence of quite sustained moves above the respective 200-day moving averages, we could be moving into a period of time where stock markets underperform and range. Now, if we start to think about that in terms of the long term, that we have the rise of the global middle class, which has been an impressive bull market for the last 6 or 7 years, and it's a trend right now which is under some pressure but is unlikely to reverse. Well, technological innovation is just accelerating higher, and that's not something that's likely to change anytime soon. The performance of the stock market doesn't really have a correlation with the pace of technological innovation. Certainly the stock market has an influence on how that innovation is valued, but the pace of innovation will continue, and it is only accelerating. That's the kind of innovation that can create productivity growth. And due to the revolution in unconventional oil and gas, and the competition that we're getting between major suppliers, the fact that solar and wind are becoming progressively more usable, not least because battery technology is improving. And there is also the potential that at some point in the next decade, we might have usable prototypes for fusion reactors. In addition, you know, the announcement late last year that artificial photosynthesis has been achieved means that the potential for a hydrogen-based economy is becoming progressively more realizable. that all contributes to the potential for oil prices to fail to get back up to the peaks that we saw less than a year ago. That the chances are that we could see oil prices ranging for the lengthy medium term. And you know, that represents quite a considerable tax cut for the vast majority of consumers. That suggests then that we really are in a secular bull market, and that the breakout from lengthy ranges seen in the last 2 years is or does represent the beginning of a new secular bull market, and a secular bull market can persist for upwards of 20 years. But a secular bull market, by the same token, does not go in a straight line. And we have to ask ourselves, is it possible that following a breakout, a range can pull back and test the upper side of the underlying trading range? And the answer is yes. And that probably represents the worst case scenario. It could just as easily consolidate above the underlying trading range. But the most likely scenario is that following the massive reaction against the prevailing trend, that people start to ask, has anything really changed? And their answer will probably be no. But the pressure of volatility, the pressure of the increased rate at which markets are moving around necessitates that large players reduce their position sizes, because they simply cannot. That moves the risk metrics, and pension funds, insurance companies simply cannot have that kind of volatility in their models. Well, that will contribute in all likelihood to a ranging environment, and eventually we're going to have normalization of interest rates. The Fed, one way or the other, is moving towards eventually rising, making its first interest rate hike. It's still entirely debatable exactly when that will be, and it'll probably be a while before they make their second hike. But the US economy is strong enough now that if they want to avoid inflation, that they would begin to raise interest rates. And the unwinding of quantitative easing, which has been extraordinary by any definition of that word, suggests that we have never been here before. And to anticipate that it would be entirely orderly is rather a wishful thinking rather than any kind of realistic possibility. When we look at two-year yields, there's a progression of higher reaction lows that has been evident for a year and a half. And expectations for when the first interest rate hike will happen have been wrong for years. But that progression of higher reaction lows suggests that every time the rallies occur, they're meeting with resistance at progressively lower levels. That supply of two-year notes is becoming progressively more dominant. It means then that they're going to be a reasonably bad investment, that the very short-term notes would be a better investment. And we have a progression of higher reaction lows on the 10-year yield for the last 6 or 7 months. So this is probably the biggest bull market in history, and it is losing consistency. And that isn't something that really anyone who's active in the market has lived through. You'd have to be as old as David, or at least a contemporary of David's, to have lived through a real bear market in bonds. So while we're in this environment where the US economy is doing better, and the requirement of the federal government to continue to increase the debt load is declining, well, this isn't a particularly benign environment for corporations, where they've been binging on debt. And obviously for companies like Apple, where their debt to equity ratio is still very low despite the amount of debt that they've taken on, and that's really only using debt to migrate some of their offshore capital back home. But Apple isn't the only company in the world, and you know, there will be business models predicated on access to cheap capital. In other words, you know, Warren Buffett's adage that you don't know who's been swimming naked until the tide goes out is likely to come to fruition when a lot of this debt matures and needs to be refinanced. High yield debt very rarely is it actually paid off. It's more often refinanced. And the big hurdles for refinancing are in 2018 and 2019. And that's when we could have, you know, a much bigger squall in equity markets. And against that background, what we're presented with right now is really probably only a first step above the base. It suggests then that we will be presented with a more attractive buying opportunity within the context of a secular bull market. And, you know, I think that is perhaps the more important point to consider. When we look at Europe is really only beginning on, it's printed about €500 billion, and it's got another €500 billion to go before this particular program has run its course. So they're halfway through their quantitative easing program. And that continues to represent really quite a significant tailwind. And it's also a medium-term bearish factor for the euro. So the euro has been unwinding its oversold condition, and it was weaker in here today following really quite a concerted strength early in the week. It has the euro is now the plaything of carry traders. It's the carry trade currency of choice, and the inverse correlation between the stock market and the euro is still very much in evidence. So European stocks pulled back incredibly sharply at the beginning of the week and have bounced back really rather impressively as the euro has weakened once more. Well, that's probably unlikely to change, not least because of the relative strength of the dollar, and also because of the relative discount of European equities to their US counterparts. It kind of means then that Europe is lagging the performance of the US and probably by about 3 years. And when we look at most of the major indices, then they are still well below their 2008 peaks. And the DAX as a total return index is an exception there. The FTSE has been ranging for 15 years, for example, and it pulled back really rather aggressively over the last number of months, but over the course of the next decade, it will probably experience really quite a concerted advance. This is an environment where it would have paid to have had a stop, but on an investment position, probably better to have out of the money call options, not least because we have this environment where algorithmic trading systems and ETFs are contributing to single stock and ETF volatility. And I guess this isn't something that is really going to change. Therefore, owning things at an attractive price and engaging in a buy and hold strategy and allowing volatility to run its course without overly affecting the investment portfolio is certainly a potential strategy, but it is contingent on achieving an attractive price for investments that really does necessitate taking a long-term view. And not just looking at the last day or the last couple of weeks of trading activity. That myopia using that kind of strategy would be really very dangerous, because if you are going to buy and hold, then
what you absolutely need to do is to manage the average buy price. And you know, that's going to be progressively harder to do as prices appreciate. This, you know, these types of squalls in the market are the kinds of opportunities that one can get to really achieve attractive entry points. So having a view that when you see a large pullback in something that you like, then that really is the time to be engaging in nibbling and to be buying. And you know, this is the kind of situation that is going to throw up some, you know, really very attractive buying opportunities. And you know, by the same token, that when something accelerates way away from the mean, well, then that is the time to have a trailing stop. That is the time to think about, well, what really would have to happen before you would take some profits or take a little bit of money off the table in the hope of getting a more attractive entry point. Well, these are big questions to ruminate on. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend. I wish all the best to all of you.